Great local programming, a trusted news source, and your favorites from NPR. All made possible with your support. And when you visit WYPR.org, click on Donate.
I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Olive Kittredge is one of literature's most fascinating characters. She's irascible, grumpy, and flummoxed by all of the changes in her small town in Maine and in the world at large. She is the invention of the author Elizabeth Strout, who won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2009 for the set of stories woven around Olive's life. Elizabeth Strout is my guest today. In her two latest books, we are introduced to Lucy Barton, a successful novelist with a hardscrabble past that includes a mother who reminds me, at least, a little of Olive. In all of her books, Strout's characters are intriguing, complicated, beautifully elucidated, and a joy to meet. Today, we'll meet Elizabeth Strout. She joins me right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you are with us today. My guest is Elizabeth Strout. She is the author of six novels and many short stories. Her most recent book is a series of linked stories called Anything is Possible. Linking stories together was a structural device that Ms. Strout also employed in what is perhaps her most well-known work, Olive Kittredge. She won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for that wonderful book back in 2009, and Frances McDormand starred in an adaptation of that story for HBO in 2014. That series won 8 Emmy Awards. Elizabeth Strout writes about people with big hearts who often live in small towns. A disgruntled former school teacher, Somali immigrants, a school janitor, a successful writer who returns to rural Illinois to reunite with her estranged siblings. We meet these and many, many more complicated and brilliant and flawed and eloquent characters who are powerfully and compellingly portrayed by a writer whose tremendous gifts of observation and explication are imbued with great magnanimity and compassion. Elizabeth Strout is speaking at Goucher College tonight, and for the next hour, she's locked in a soundproof booth with me, poor thing. Elizabeth Strout, I am delighted to meet you. How are you doing?
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. Thank you so much.
I'm so happy for on a number of levels to be able to meet you, because the one is that I can tell you just how much your work means to me, how compelling it is, how powerful it is, how it's made me a better person, and anybody who knows me will tell you that that's a very tall order, very tall order. But you're just one of my favorite writers, so I'm delighted to be able to get to meet you.
It's just wonderful to hear. Thank you so much. I'm so glad I've made you a better person.
Small. That's right. One step at a time. I want to talk about a phrase that is uttered or described in the newest book, Anything is Possible. There's a character named Patty Nicely, who is a counselor at a high school. And she comes across a book by a woman who grew up in the town she is from, named Lucy Barton. And she reads this book, and she's taken by it, just as I am taken by the four books of yours that I've read. And she says the book had understood her. And I love that formulation. It's not I understood this book,
right,
but the book,
right,
understood her.
Right.
So what,
right,
aspirationally,
right,
what do you want your books to understand?
Well, you know, I think that I just want, there's probably two things that I hope for the reader to take away. And first of all, it has to be a reader who's ready for the book, you know, at that point in their life to receive it, and might not be, you know, for everybody. But what I would like to do is help the reader, two things. I would like the reader to help see the world they live in a little bit of a larger way, and then I'd like them to recognize themselves as well in what they're reading, so that they could understand that, you know, all those awful thoughts that they think they've had or that they've had, you know, have been had by everybody all over the world for many, many centuries, probably.
And the duality of that is really an interesting dimension of literature, isn't it? That it's at once a very personal experience to read a book.
Right.
I mean, it's
right.
you and the book.
Right.
It's
exactly.
not something you do in a crowd.
That's right.
You know?
It's you and that voice
it's
that comes
you,
out.
You and
yeah.
that voice.
Yeah.
And that voice, you might say, oh, that's me.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I understand her.
Right.
On the other hand, it is universal because you read that book, you get to know these characters and you say, I know someone like that.
Exactly.
Or I've seen that
exactly.
before.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That's what I'm hoping. You know, to do. And if I can tell the truth, then that might happen.
Oh, there's that. There's yeah. the truth.
yeah, well, whatever that is. But
yeah,
you know.
Whatever that is. But so right. is it a specific, you know, a specific set of observations that lead you to the truth? I mean, how do we determine the
oh,
truth?
Oh, I know. I wish I hadn't brought that up.
yeah, <sir.
laughs> but
your
okay.
fault. Sorry.
I know it's totally my fault. I guess I mean that if there's something that is emotionally truthful in the book, the reader has a much better chance of recognizing themselves and other people. So it's taken me a lifetime to recognize, okay, this sentence is truthful because of that.
Yeah. I mean, authenticity
yeah.
and sincerity is easy to spot
yeah.
and probably easy to understand if it's not.
Exactly.
I mean, all of us
right.
have an innate capacity to say, nah,
I think you're
that
exactly
doesn't ring
right.
right.
I yeah. think you're exactly right. And the reader might not even know it as they're reading, but they'll lose interest.
Yeah.
And just say, oh, well, that wasn't, you know, but it's probably oftentimes, I think, because it's just not truthful enough.
Because this latest book, and you've got six novels, and I'll confess I haven't read the first two, and I can't wait. So I came to your work at Olive Kittredge,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people know that book. It won the Pulitzer Prize. Mm-hmm. It was made into that wonderful series on HBO. And I've read all the ones since then, The Burgess Boys, and then My Name is Lucy Barton, in which we are introduced
right.
to Lucy, and then Anything is Possible, this latest one, is a series of stories in the people kind of in the circle of Lucy Barton.
Right.
So talk about Lucy and how she plays into this latest creation of yours and how
right.
she sort of hovers through that
right.
those stories.
You know, when I was writing My Name is Lucy Barton, I wrote and I listened, you know, I heard in my head and I wrote down the scenes with her mother in the hospital room, and they would be talking about people from Lucy's past. And I would think to myself, I wonder what did happen to those Pretty Nicely girls. I wonder what, you know, what did happen to Kathy Nicely? And so I was interested, and I would write little scenes way down at the other end of the table, and I just sort of left them there. And then by the time My Name is Lucy Barton was done, I realized, oh, let's have a book of these people because they were very compelling to me. So in Anything is Possible, Lucy is, except for one story, she's absent. You know, so it's not like Olive Kittredge who's there connecting all these stories. Her absence connects the stories in a certain kind of way. Yeah.
Did you start, while you're writing My Name is Lucy Barton, did you start writing these sort of backstories of all of these people in order to understand Lucy? I talk to a lot of fiction writers. They seem to fall into two camps. They'll say, the characters lead me along, and I end up going where they're going. And the others are people who say, you know, I write little autobiographies or biographies of each person in the
yeah.
in the thing, backstories that may not make it into the book, but they inform who
right.
that person is for me in my mind's eye as I'm creating him
right.
or her. Did it start like that, or did it start, you say, boy, that's a really great little story I had Lucy and her mother talk about. I'll save that for later.
That's really what happened. I don't write backstories for my characters. I just sort of watch them unfold, you know, as they do what they do. And it was more what you just said, which is that I would think to myself, oh, what did, you know, what was that about? Let's think about that. And I wasn't sure if it would come to anything, but by the time I was done, I realized, no, I've got a book.
Yeah. And it was any of that stuff at any point, did you think about including it in the book? I mean,
I would go back and forth. You know, it's like, yes, there were parts, trying to think now, like I realized, oh, okay, let's get Elvis. Let's make sure the mother talks about Elvis, because Elvis is going to be part of Mississippi Mary's life. You know, so there were pieces that I would kind of make sure we're there if I wanted to do that.
Yeah. I mean, Joyce Carol Oates, I think, very famously said, you know, when it comes to writing books, it's all about editing. It's all about cutting stuff out.
Right.
And she talks about the things she cuts as her little darlings, you know.
Right.
I have to say goodbye to the little darlings. I talked to Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, a novelist I just admire. She's
wonderful,
terrific. She lives right here in Maryland, actually. She lives in Columbia.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And she says she has a file of those. She has a file of the little darlings that she's taken out of various essays and books and stories that she may come back to at some point.
Right.
Do you have a file like that?
I don't. I don't have any files at all. I'm such a messy worker. I really, it's not embarrassing, but it's a little bit embarrassing because I'm just a very messy writer. And if they don't work, then they just end up getting thrown on the floor and eventually, you know, put into a garbage can. But so I don't keep files. I just work on what I work on, and if it works, it works, and if it doesn't, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. So you're editing as you're going along? I mean, do you write entire books and then write another entire version of the entire book and then another entire version? Sometimes folks do that.
You know, I will write probably two paragraphs, and I will immediately begin to rewrite those two paragraphs. So by the time they stay on the table, as opposed to getting tossed off, they're already pretty well rewritten, because I'll just rewrite them even as I'm moving forward.
So by the end of the book, you're not expecting a massive overhaul.
Not really.
Yeah.
Not really, because if the sentence isn't good, then the sentences that come after it aren't going to be good.
Yeah.
For me.
And the sentence has to be good.
The sentence has to be very good, because that's how I can convey to the reader what needs to be conveyed. It's all in the sentence.
So you're not thinking paragraphs, chapters,
no.
sections.
No, it's sentence. The sentence has to be just right.
Are there readers that you have, I don't know, your agent maybe, or your editors at your publisher, or friends or colleagues you respect, that are reading those sentences and giving you advice, saying,
yes, I have,
that sentence could be better?
Well, I have one reader, and I've had her for almost 35 years. And I met her when I first moved to New York, 35 years ago. And she has remained my one and really only reader until I turn it in. Because we were both trying to write fiction many, many years ago, and I understood that she understands my sensibilities. So that's enormously important, and I trust her, and that's enormously important. So when I get something to a point where I no longer know what to do with it, then it goes to my friend Kathy.
Mm-hmm.
And she's the one I dedicated my name as Lucy Barton to.
Oh.
So she'll be my first reader.
She's a writer as well?
Yes.
You read her stuff?
Yes.
So this is mutual relationship.
Yes, and she has just written a wonderful biography of Jane Carlyle Welch.
Oh. And your sensibilities. When she has this deep understanding of yours, how would you describe those sensibilities to a stranger like me?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. I think that she understands what I'm trying to do with the reader. She understands that I'm not interested in anything that's fancy, or I just want the sentence to get across. And it has to sound right and be right, and you know, the whole story. And I that's a good question. I'm not.
Yeah, well, maybe it doesn't. It's not able to be answered because there's certain things.
Right.
You know, it's like the taste of an orange.
Right.
You know, do you have to describe it? I mean, you just know what it is. You know.
Right.
You're giving a talk this afternoon in just a few hours at Goucher College, which you've entitled Why You Don't Have to Worry About Plot.
Mm-hmm.
Most writers would say, oh my gosh, I spend lots of time worrying about plot. Why not? Why don't you have to worry about plot?
Well, first of all, I just don't like that word, plot. Mm-hmm. It's just not a nice sounding word. And years ago, my friend Kathy, you know, she spent a lot of time worrying about plot, and I learned from that, and I thought, I'm not going to worry about that. And so I don't. And so I write in scenes and then watch the scenes connect. And really all that has to happen is that something has to change. That's all.
Yeah. That's what a plot is. It goes from one thing to the next thing.
That's right.
Yeah,
so.
that's interesting. I never thought about how the word plot It's a terrible word.
It's a terrible word.
I now hate saying it.
I know.
It shall be the word that is never to be spoken again.
Exactly.
All right, we're going to take a little break, and we'll come back more with Elizabeth Strout. Her latest book is called Anything is Possible. She won the Pulitzer Prize for Olive Kittredge back in 2009. Our phone number, if you'd like to join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. If you want to join us on Twitter, that's a swell idea, @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday, and we are very, very grateful for that very fact. By the way, coming up tomorrow, Dr. Miho Tanaka will be my guest. She's an internationally recognized orthopedic surgeon and the director of the Women's Sports Medicine Program at Johns Hopkins. The Baltimore Running Festival is coming up on Saturday, and tomorrow Dr. Tanaka will take your questions about how best to recover if you're running the full or half marathon, and how best to train and avoid injury for whatever physical endeavor you choose to do. We jokingly refer to our shows with Dr. Tanaka as What Hurts Today. We'll talk about it tomorrow. It's always fun, and we always have lots of stuff to talk about with Dr. Tanaka. So join us tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Elizabeth Strout. Her most recent book is Anything is Possible. It's a series of stories that expand upon some of the people that we met in the bestseller she wrote before that, My Name is Lucy Barton. Olive Kittredge is the book that won her the Pulitzer back in 2009. Our phone number to join our conversation with Elizabeth Strout, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. I think one of the reasons I find all of your characters so compelling is that they are unpredictable in a lot of ways. I mean, at their heart, likable. I mean, even a character like Olive Kittredge, who's,
yeah,
you know, curmudgeon-y.
She's
a tough cookie,
yeah,
you know?
She's a tough cookie.
But you love her.
I'm glad.
You can't, you're rooting for her.
I'm glad.
You know? So is likability important to you? I remember talking to Ann Tyler about this. She said, you know, it takes me about a year to write a book. And when I invent this little community of people, I don't want to fool around with people I don't like if I have to hang out with them for a year.
Right. You know, likability is, well, I have to have a relationship with the characters. And the relationship, I've learned over the years that my relationship with them is love. I love them. And so if I love them, then they stay on the table and I work with them. And so the other thing I do when I work, I've noticed, is that I suspend judgment. So they can do what they need to do, because I love them, so they can go off and do whatever they need to do and be as badly behaved as they want to be or need to be. And that's okay with me. And I always remember at one point when I was writing Olive Kittredge, I thought, uh-oh, you know, I might be going too far. Her behavior is really, you know, pretty bad. And I remember exactly where I was standing, and I thought, no, let her be Olive. And that was like this moment that I thought, that's right. And so ever since, I just think, let them be who they are.
Yeah, you don't
let
have to force her into things. Yeah,
just let them be.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
it seems to me you are an acute observer of the passing parade. Are you one of those writers with the notebooks that's always,
I am always
on the subway, in the cab?
Yes, always on the subway especially. I just love watching people. I just love it. I just watch them and watch them and watch them.
Now, are models important to you then? I mean, are you disinclined, for example, to completely invent someone for whom you don't have any vague model? I mean, would you be disinclined to write a novel set in ancient Greece or in the year 2525 or something like that?
I would be disinclined to do that because I'm interested in the people that I see. You know, that's just who I am and what I do. And I'm just so interested in the people that I'm watching. And there was a couple on the subway years ago. There was a couple, and they made their way into Olive Kittredge. Because many years later, as I was working on the story Starving with Harmon sitting out by the marina, all of a sudden I remembered, oh, that couple on the subway, this darling girl was sitting on her boyfriend's lap. And she was saying, I know you're smelling me. Stop smelling me. And I just always remembered that couple. And so, and I had to make her sick because, you know, it was a story.
Yeah, that's it. You got a little tragedy,
but,
here and there.
But anyway,
sprinkle it in.
So I remember things many years later sometimes.
Yeah.
So.
You grew up in small towns in New England.
Yes.
Small towns play a big role in Olive Kittredge, which I guess it's in Crosby, Maine, and that's a fictitious place,
yes,
right?
Yes.
But Lucy Barton, she grew up in
Amgash.
Amgash, right. Illinois. That's a real place.
No, it's not. I made that up.
Did you?
Yeah.
Because I Googled it, and there's a thing
there's
on the
map. Amgash?
I think so. I Googled Amgash, Illinois, and some little dot came up. I think so.
Oh.
I'll double check after we're done.
Wow. But, okay, know, I yeah. apologize.
Yeah, or maybe it's spelled differently or something in real life, but there is a place in Illinois called Amgash, right? And yours is in Illinois or is it in Iowa?
Mine's in Illinois.
Yeah, Illinois. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's it.
Wow. Okay.
And our staff will Google it as we speak, and Mr. Google or Mrs. Google will tell us. Amgash, and it's spelled A-M-G-E-A-S-H. All right, Amgash, Illinois. The importance of place, the fact that these characters exist in a very small town, and they know each other, and they know stuff about each other, and it's amazing what they don't know about
each other.
You know, we hear a lot, and we've heard a lot since the election last November about the great dichotomy between the coasts, the left and the right coast, L.A., New York, and the so-called heartland, where this town is. Is there a difference between the small towns on the coasts and the small towns in the heartlands? I mean, a small town in Maine is still a small town, but it's East Coast.
Right. You know, I think there is. I just think that there is some sort of character that these different regions have. And Maine is certainly its own country. I mean, that coastline is so jagged and beautiful and rough, and the people who have lived there a long, long time somehow seem to incorporate some of that. And then the people who live in the Midwest are, it's not a great difference, but there is a small difference in how they behave and move around.
Given the universality that we talked about in that first segment, I mean, is there a fundamental difference between people living in Illinois and Ohio and Iowa and Nebraska and the people living in Maryland or Connecticut and Maine? And
no, I think probably not. I think there's no fundamental difference, but I think that the differences are there and matter to some extent.
So what do you make of that narrative about the campaign that, you know, people, progressives on the left, didn't understand the pain and the difficulties that people in rural America in particular were having? The other divide that we sort of alighted upon after the election was metro versus rural, meaning city folk versus rural folks, not even suburban folks.
Right.
But Hillary Clinton won 500 out of 3,000 counties.
Right.
And the 500 counties she won represent 65% of the economy.
Right.
So the 2,500 counties that the president won were very small.
Right.
What do you make of that narrative that there's this incredible chasm between the two parts?
I think there's some truth to that. I don't think it's the whole story, but I certainly think that there is truth to that. There are people that have, over the years, you know, lost the jobs in the mills and lost the you know, industrial jobs that they've had, and have watched during their lifetime their opportunities shrink, and they just feel angry and they don't understand why.
By the way, Uncle Google has called in. Mm-hmm. Amgash, Illinois is Strout's invention.
Okay.
So far, the score is Elizabeth 2, Tom 0. I swear to God, just upstairs a half hour ago, I Googled it and something came up with an arrow. So I don't know what I was doing. I mean, evidently, I can't even
work
Google.
Well, that makes me feel
relieved. So you're off the hook. False alarm, fake news.
Thank you.
Calm down. Let's go to the phones. Christian in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Elizabeth Strout.
Hello. I wanted to ask if your setting is a conscious character. So, for example, the small towns that have been a part of your work, or in particular the main small, you know, the concept of that is something that you work in as an element of how people interact, not just between the people, but knowing that telling this person this thing is going to automatically mean that these other five people know it. Because even if they don't tell anyone but their close friends that this subset of people that they'll all know it. And then, you know, even if one of them tell, you know, especially like, I mean, physical setting has that effect as well, but at least from the works of yours that I've read, it's been a somewhat less dramatic part of it than the social side of a setting.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, I think that place is very important and time in history is important. So if you have people that are living in a certain place in a certain time in history, then their story will be a specific kind of story. So there's that. And then, yes, I do think I'm more interested in the social interactions than I am necessarily the physical descriptions of the town. But the idea of these people living in a small town where, you know, let's say Olive Kittredge walks down the street and somebody thinks they know her, but they really only know a part of her. And then somebody else thinks they know her, but they really only know a very small part of her. And yet, you know, that sort of thing is interesting to me, the different points of views that people can have in a small town, thinking they know a lot and yet not knowing the full picture.
Thanks for that call, Christian. You wrote an essay in the Washington Post about 4 months ago about class and about your
right.
understanding of class and the sort of revelation that you had after you'd written a few
right.
books that
right.
maybe you were writing about
right.
class. I was interested in that. The four books of yours that I've read, I did not think of those in terms of class. How are they reflective of our situation, you know, nationally
right.
in the body politic
right.
around class?
Well, I mean, for example, my name is Lucy Barton. That was the one that I really, at that point, I was very conscious of class, and I thought, okay, I'm going to take this young girl from a very, very poor background, and every rural town has a family like Lucy's. And I'm going to take her, and she'll escape through her education, and she'll get out, and she will cross class lines and become arguably, you know, an upper middle class woman. And then, so that's when I started. And then I looked back with Anything Is Possible, and I realized, you know, her sister is working class. She works at the nursing home. Her husband is not employed. You know, so I think that those are parts of the Trump world that we maybe don't know about.
And people talk about the president's lack of empathy.
Yeah.
And they talk about the progressive left's lack of empathy for those people who are displaced by globalization or automation in the manufacturing job they had, or entire towns that are wiped out because the one major
right.
employer has been shipped off to Bangladesh
right.
or, you know, Mexico or something. Our mutual friend Madison Smart Bell talks about with his characters, he dreams himself in to their characters,
it's
to his characters.
Phrase.
I think it's a wonderful phrase.
Wonderful.
I mean, what will it take for us to dream ourselves in
right.
to
right.
people who are not living in Manhattan or
that's
Baltimore,
right.
or,
exactly.
but they're living in Amgash, Illinois.
Exactly, exactly. Well, I mean, I hope, you know, I mean, it sounds grandiose, I suppose, but I hope that by writing books about these people, you know, that people who are not like them can realize, oh, I get that. That's their situation, and I get that. And now I have a better understanding of who these people might be.
Anything Is Possible, as you said, is a series of linked stories, the way that Olive Kittredge is linked stories, although Olive herself is present mm-hmm. all the time, as you mentioned. Choosing that as a structural artifice, does that present particular challenges? Are there things about it that make it easier than if you were writing a sort of so-called chapter book, or does it present things that, you know, hurdles
right.
you gotta
right.
jump over?
It was just different. It wasn't any more difficult or any easier. It was just different I understood right away with both those books that the form would be what it is, and that was helpful because the form is the book. And so I understood that these would be different people from Lucy's past, and that Lucy would pretty much stay off stage. Like I said, she does, you know, enter once, and
mm-hmm.
that was a decision that I had to make, and I had to sort of figure out how to do that. But
you could almost read the book as a series of short stories.
Yes.
I mean, you could read them sort of one chapter at a time. Does
right.
the order of the stories mean a lot to you?
Yes, it does. I don't know how I do it, but that's intuition. I just intuitively realize, okay, we're going to start with Tommy Guptill, and we're going to see Pete Barton, and then we're going to move on to Patty Nicely, and then we're going to see her sister. And it So, yes, the order does matter very much to me.
And these are all people that, if you have read My Name is Lucy Barton, you heard alluded to in the conversations between Lucy and her mother.
Right.
Is it absolutely necessary for a reader to have read Lucy Barton first and then read anything
that's
possible?
No, not at all. I think anything
is
possible.
And you designed it with that in mind.
That's right. That's right. They're two separate books, but they are connected if you happen to read both of them.
Yeah, because I got Anything's Possible first, and then I realized that it was related to Lucy Barton, so then I made sure that I read Lucy Barton first, and then I read that one just for kicks.
Right, but I don't think you have to.
The title, Anything is Possible, it brought to mind that great Steve Martin line where he'd say, it's impossible to stick a Cadillac up your nose. It's impossible. He was doing like a Sammy Davis Jr. Spoof.
Right.
Is anything really possible?
Well, no, of course not, because no. But and I thought about that later, and I thought, I've possibly written a false sentence for the title, but in this book, what's possible are these little moments of grace that come to these characters who would never have expected to have these moments of grace. And so that is really what's possible. And in the very last, it's the very last line of the book as well. So Abel Blaine is thinking anything's possible. And I thought, okay, I'm going to call it that.
And grace is at the heart of all of these people.
Yeah.
All of our lives.
Right, right.
It's those fleeting moments
of grace.
We can, sometimes you go days or months without them.
Right.
And then when they
when they show up, it just makes so much difference.
Yeah. We have an email from Susan who says, I love these novels, especially Olive Kittredge and the Burgess Boys. We'll talk a little bit about Burgess Boys in a second. Can't wait to read the new one. I'm curious about Ms. Strout's writing discipline. Do you write every day?
You know, I try and write. I try and write 5 days a week. It's my job. It's my job, and it always has been. And I've understood that for a long time. It was more difficult when I was, raising my daughter. Trying to run the house and raising my daughter and stuff like that. But I do try and write 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, and I will sometimes, work on it on a weekend if something comes to me. But it's my job, and so I will write as soon after breakfast as my husband leaves the house. I will begin to write and, write for probably 4 or 5 hours, pushing lunch off as long as I can, because there's something about having lunch that breaks it for me.
How old is your daughter?
She's 34.
Okay, so she's not living at home, one assumes.
Right, yeah. Right.
Uh-huh. God bless.
Yes,
And is the place you write really important? I mean, do you need to write in that studio in your home in New York, or can you write in Starbucks?
I can write anywhere. I've always been able to write anywhere. I prefer to work either at home in New York or in Maine. I do have a studio that I go to, which is great. But I actually can write anywhere. I've always been able to do that. Yeah.
That's great. Elizabeth Strout is my guest. She's speaking at Goucher College today and tonight in events sponsored by the Kratz Center for Creative Writing. We'll have details about those appearances at the end of our show today, and we'll have more with Elizabeth Strout after a quick break. 410-662-8780. You want to send us an email, midday@wipr.org, if you want to join the throngs of people following us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. Stick around. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, the internationally acclaimed author Elizabeth Strout is my guest. She's the author of 6 novels, short stories that have appeared in Red Book, 17, and many literary magazines, and she's the editor of 3 collections of short stories by other writers. She holds a law degree, and she won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for Olive Kittredge in 2009. She's speaking tonight at Goucher College as part of the Kratz Center for Creative Writing's series of authors that they have come to the campus up in Towson. If you'd like to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wipr.org, and to find us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. You won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. That's huge. It's just huge. I mean, particularly, I've been doing this job at WYPR for about 15 years, 14 years, and the number of books that I get sent to me every, and our staff gets sent to us every week, is astonishing. Yeah. It's amazing how many people are writing books.
Right.
And when all those really good people sometimes write books, right, and you win the prize that says this is the best piece of fiction in the year 2009, that had to have changed some, it had to have adjusted the DNA in your head and the rest of your body somehow. I mean, what's that experience meant for you now, over these last 10 years almost?
Right. Well, I think, you know, I was, I don't know, 50-something. I honestly can't remember how old I mean, I can't do the math, but I was in my 50s when I won it. 53, I don't know. But, and I think my DNA was already pretty settled. my point. Mm-hmm. If I had been younger, it might have been a different thing. So, but it was great. It was just great. There's no downside to winning the Pulitzer at that age.
Or any age, I suppose.
Or any age, right.
Right, right. And, of course, it got made into this beautiful series on HBO, and I thought Frances McDormand, who also
wonderful.
Produced it.
Yeah.
So were you directly involved in the writing, the screenplay, or any part of it?
No, because I don't know anything about screenwriting, and I'm just not interested in trying to learn at this point. And so I had a number of talks with Frances about the character of Olive. I had one very long talk with the screenwriter and basically said, go ahead and do what you want. And then I had one very long talk with the director, and that was it.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't?
No.
Were you on set?
We went on set one night.
Just for fun?
Just for fun. It was fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you really didn't know what was going to happen until you saw the screen?
I did not know. And then I saw it and I thought, oh my God, this is so wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I agree. Yeah. And a lot of people concur. Won 8 Emmy Awards. Yeah. She's a terrific artist.
She's wonderful.
And she was the producer of it, too. I mean, she was the driving force behind this thing.
Right. And Richard Jenkins was so great.
Yeah. Well, he plays her husband.
Yeah.
And Robert Redford, as I understand it, is developing The Burgess Boys.
Right.
Which takes place in another small town in Maine, Lewiston,
right.
Maine. That is a real place, right?
But it's called Shirley Falls in the book.
Right.
Yeah.
And
yes.
What's up with that? What's the
we're waiting to
date of delivery.
I'm not sure, but I think hopefully they'll be going into production in February.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure.
Great.
Still waiting to hear. Right.
That, as you say, it takes place in another small town, and it's about immigration. I mean, it's amazing how topical your books are. I don't know if that was purposeful.
But it's so odd. It is. It's like I'm prescient or something.
Yeah. You know, because, we talk about the rural metro divide, and now this is about immigration.
And it's the story of the day right now. It's about the Somali population that did move to Maine starting in about 2000, and it's the one book that I used a real incident from life in very specifically, which was that there was a fellow who did throw a pig's head through a mosque in Lewiston, Maine, a number of years ago. And when I read that, I just was captivated. And the fellow that I have throwing the pig's head in is a very different fellow from the one who actually did it. You know, I've made him quite younger and more baffled and, you know, made everybody more baffled.
And it's about family, too.
It's about family, exactly.
Because it's two brothers.
That's right.
One in New York, one, you know, and they're lawyers, but different kinds of lawyers.
Yeah.
And then they have a sister.
And they have that sister who's still in Maine.
Yeah, the kid is related.
And the kid,
he's a nephew. And
And
then, of course, you know, just this week, there's a bombing in Mogadishu, some 300 plus people were killed. It was one of the worst terrorist incidents in the history of that country. What does that do to a town with so many Somali nationals living in this small community in Maine when things are, I'm sure, touch? I mean, in Lewiston, Maine, as I understand it, in 2002, the mayor had some very unwelcoming things to say. He said, basically, you Somalis are not welcome.
It was terrible. And I still think that, you know, a great deal of the Somali population there still feels that they want to go home. But they can't. Now they can't even go home to visit. And that's really, really sad and horrible that even since I wrote that book, they can't even go back for their... some of them would go back if they could afford to for a year's visit. So I think it's a really, really terrible situation for them.
Are you aware of the fact that that book, The Burgess Boys, is on a list that used to be called Ferguson Reads, and now it's called, like, Black Lives Matter Reading List? It is one of the things that that movement has suggested as a way of understanding the other. And
I'm
understanding
so glad.
It. Yeah.
I was not aware of that, and I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, that's really quite
it's fabulous.
I read a review by a Somalian or a Somali person who actually took note of the fact that you know the distinction between using the term Somali and Somalian.
Yeah.
I didn't know the I still don't know the distinction.
Right.
So that you researched this.
Right. I did. I spent 7 years researching the Somali population.
Can you tell me what the difference between Somali and Somalian is?
Well, Somalian is just not, it's not the word.
It's not a real word. So you should never say Somalian.
Right. No, no.
You should say Somali. Because I hear it and see it written all the time.
Yeah, right. Somali.
The Burgess Boys. You wrote a sort of like a mini memoir right around the time you won the Pulitzer in the Post, I think, Washington Post, about a experience you had as a teenager living in England.
Right.
And again, the topicality of this is quite something because here we have Harvey Weinstein and you hooked up with this guy or didn't hook. I shouldn't use that term because it means something different than when you and I were teenagers. But you fell into the circle of this guy
who
you know had a very different take on your relationship, shall we say.
Right.
But the thing I learned, one of the things I learned about that is how far off the grid you were when you grew up.
Yeah.
I mean, when we say you grew up in rural Maine,
it
was serious rural.
It was so serious rural. It was so outside of the popular culture that it's almost mind-boggling.
And I mention it because you address that as one of the reasons that you had than a little bit of naivete going into this situation.
A huge amount of naivete.
I had another life as a classical musician and as a pop musician, and you also had a life a little bit as a pop musician. You played some bars, a bar or two, so you and I were both lounge lizards at one time in our life. And I was always fascinated by the example of Franz Joseph Haydn, who worked in this little dinky town called Esterhazy for the royal family, you know, the aristocracy. And it was way outside of Vienna. He was in the middle of the woods. And so he had to have his musicians and he had to give lessons to the daughters of the family and he had to, you know, perform for their little soirees in the evening and stuff. And he was just out of the mainstream. He wasn't in town.
Right.
And he said, I had to be original.
Interesting.
Because I wasn't in the mainstream.
Right.
I wasn't walking around downtown Vienna.
That's so interesting.
Do you think that might apply to you as well?
Oh, I think it has to. I think it really has to. Because I just was not in the world for those young...
I mean,
young,
like no TV.
No TV. There were books. I had plenty of books. I had piano lessons. But there was something that was so far removed from the real world for quite a long time. And I think that it's made me the writer that I am because a number of reasons. First of all, I had to rely on, you know, I had many inner resources developing as a result of, there were no other, you know, it wasn't like I was part of society where you get support from, you know, whatever. So there were many, many inner resources that developed. And then also I think that, you know, my look was a fresh look.
Yeah, had to be.
Had to be.
Right.
Exactly.
I had to be original, as
Haydn
said. Yeah, that's interesting. You went to law school. You and I graduated from college the same year, just a few years ago. And and you went to law school. You also had done a bunch of other things. You know, you were a waitress.
Oh,
you
my
played
word.
Played bars. You know, you worked in a office in a textile factory. I mean, all the kinds of, you know, little gigs that we do as we're making our way in the world. What was the allure of law school at the time?
Well, basically, nobody was even remotely interested in any story that I was writing at any magazine ever. And so I began to worry. You know, and I thought, well, what will happen if I'm, you know, 58? I remember thinking that, what will happen if I'm 58 and I'm still a cocktail waitress? So that got me into law school because I thought, well, I have a social conscience. I'll do good works and I'll write at night, which is, you know, ridiculously misinformed. So I dropped out of law school, and then I went back to law school, and then I graduated, and then I was a lawyer for 6 months. And
6 months?
Yes. And I was such a bad lawyer. And what I learned during that 6 months was I learned that if I was a cocktail waitress at the age of 58 and I had not published anything, that was fine. Because it would have been an honest attempt. I remember standing on the back lawn and thinking, okay, I'm going to give it every single thing I have. And if I never am published and I end up being a cocktail waitress at the age of 58, that's okay. Because I will have tried with my whole heart.
And you were writing all along.
Writing.
So it was never
all
like
along.
You put writing aside
never.
To do these other
always,
things.
Always, always, always writing. But that's what I learned by going to law school. And I also learned legal stuff so that I was able to, you know, years later with the Burgess Boys, I was able to understand the legal stuff.
Yeah, you wrote about a bunch
right.
of lawyers.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And when you think about those experiences where you were, you write about how you weren't even noticed when you were the secretary in the secretarial pool at Bates College.
Right.
You know,
right. Where I had
professors
just
would come in and they'd throw their manuscripts and go type this. You know,
right.
And you're in a basement. I mean, that really informs your understanding of these people who are not noticed, who are not,
that's right.
who don't feel, who don't have reason
right.
to feel that they're noticed.
That's right. For their whole lives.
Yeah, and that hasn't changed, has it? I mean, that's in the 1970s or the 50s or the 30s or the 2020s. It's all the same thing.
Yeah.
What's the next project? What are you working on?
Oh, a book.
How interesting.
I would love
You've already
tell you.
Written a bunch of good ones.
I would love to tell you about it, but I can't because
That's
I
fair
just,
enough.
I just can't ever talk about what I'm working on, but I'm working on a book.
You split your time between New York and Maine?
Yes.
I mean, is it 50-50, 70-30?
Oh, it just depends. I can't figure it out. I mean, I really don't know. Sometimes it feels like it's 70-30, and sometimes it feels like it's 50-50, but I think mostly in New York.
But so when you're in Manhattan, are you yearning for the countryside? I mean,
no.
Is it one of those kinds of...
No.
Like, oh, I got to get out of here?
No.
I need fresh air?
Oh, not at all. I love New York. Yeah. I absolutely love New York.
But having grown up in the countryside,
right.
grown up in the quietude
right.
of that,
right.
It's
it makes
not,
me love New York all the more. There's people.
Actual people that
Actual
you can observe.
People all the time to watch. Exactly.
I think when you write books... And when you're finished with the book, you hand it into your publisher, and it's sitting there, you know, in your hands as an actual book, and it's no longer a manuscript. Are there things that you're surprised by? At that stage in the process, is there anything about your work that says, boy, I didn't expect this? And
you
it may
know,
not be, but I
once
just want
to... Once it's in its cover and done, it's not... in a way connected to me anymore. And there's a, you know, it's a sadness, actually. I mean, it's not a deep sadness because I've got something else that I'm always working on, but I have noticed that once it's in its cover, it's gone from me in a certain way. And
somebody
now,
else
it's,
is,
now it's yours.
You let it out. Now it's ours. All right. Well, we are glad to have
Thank
them.
Thank you.
It's really, it's a terrific body of work. As I said,
Thank
I can't
you.
Wait to read the first two. And, you know, I'm just delighted we had a chance to talk
Me
today.
Too.
It's really
it's
been
lovely.
Fun.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, Elizabeth Strout. Her six novels include Olive Kittredge, The Burgess Boys, My Name is Lucy Barton, and her latest, Anything is Possible. She's speaking this afternoon at 3 o'clock and again at 8 o'clock at Goucher College in Towson. It's part of a series produced by the Kratz Center for Creative Writing. We've got a link to information on our website, wypr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. Tomorrow, a conversation with Dr. Miho Tanaka of the Women's Sports Medicine Program over at Johns Hopkins. She's an orthopedic surgeon, and she's been the team doc for Major League Baseball teams and professional women's basketball teams and the like. The Baltimore Running Festival is coming up Saturday. Dr. Tanaka will give us some tips on how to avoid injuries if you're running one of the long races in that festival or in whatever sport you enjoy. So I hope you can join us tomorrow with Dr. Tanaka on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Really appreciate it. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.